During the day of the 16th, reckoning ourselves to be very near land, 8 of the most determined of us resolved to try to reach the coast. We unfastened a strong fish of a mast, which made part of the little parapet. We fixed boards to it at intervals, transversely by means of great nails, to hinder it from upsetting. A little mast and sail were fixed in the front. We intended to provide ourselves with oars made of barrel staves, cut out with the only saber we had remaining. We cut pieces of rope, we split them, and made smaller ropes that were more easy to manage. A hammock cloth, which was by chance on the raft, served for a sail. A certain portion of wine was assigned to us, and our departure fixed for the next day. When our machine was finished, it remained to make a trial of it. A sailor, wanting to pass from the front to the back of it, finding the mast in his way, set his foot on one of the crossboards. The weight of his body made it upset, and this accident proved to us the temerity of our enterprise. It was then resolved that we should all await death in our present situation. The cable winch fastened the machine to our raft, was made loose, and it drifted away. It is very certain that if we had ventured upon this second raft, weak as we were, we should not have been able to hold out 6 hours with our legs in the water, and thus obliged continually to row. When the night came, and its gloomy shades revived in our minds the most afflicting thoughts, we were convinced that there were not about 12 or 15 bottles of wine left in our barrel. We began to feel an invincible disgust at the flesh which had till then scarcely supported us. And we may say that the sight of it inspired us with sentiment of terror, which was doubtless produced by the idea of approaching destruction. This was the first-hand account written by Henri Savigny and Alexandre Corriard, describing their desperation as they languished on the raft of the Medusa in July of 1816. They would ultimately survive and go on to publish their entire testimony of the destruction of the frigate Medusa and their subsequent torment. The Raft of the Medusa, Part 2, today, on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, tales of mishaps, misfortune, and misadventure. I'm your host, Rich Napolitano. Thank you so much for joining me. Part 1 of this story details the purpose of the voyage of the Medusa, along with the rest of its convoy, and events leading to the Medusa being wrecked off the coast of Africa. 147 unfortunate souls were placed on a crude, unstable, makeshift raft and abandoned by Captain Chaumaret and Governor Schmaltz. If you have not yet listened to Part 1 of this story, it would be a good idea to go back and listen before continuing with Part 2. As mentioned in Part 1, this story contains possibly disturbing depictions of violence and cannibalism. Listener discretion is advised. There was silence on the raft as harsh reality set in. Corriard and Savigny wrote of this moment, "It was now that we had need of all our courage, which, however, forsook us more than once. We really believed that we were sacrificed, and with one accord, we cried that this desertion was premeditated. We all swore to revenge ourselves if we had the good fortune to reach the shore, and there is no doubt but that, if we could have overtaken the next day those who had fled in the boats, an obstinate combat would have taken place between them and us." Their raft, called La Machine by its occupants, was a sad excuse for a vessel. 20 meters long and 7 meters wide, it was constructed of the masts, yards, booms, and other fragments of the Medusa. The mass of humanity clinging to the unwieldy raft lacked even space to lie down. With uneven lengths of timber, it was an odd crisscross assortment of timbers and planks, and those on board stood with water up to their knees. Other than the small raised deck, there was no real deck to stand on, and arms, legs, and even heads frequently became tangled in the timbers below. The men still on the Medusa tossed down the main gallant and top gallant sails to the raft, although they still had no mechanism for steering. This raft, if you could even call it that, was at the mercy of the currents. In command of the raft by default was the highest-ranking sailor, Midshipman Coudin. Coudin had badly injured his leg and was in constant agony from the seawater, which aggravated his wounds. Despair set in quickly, as sailors, soldiers, and one woman understood their dire situation. Anger, fear, and panic increased as talk of revenge and certain death spread among them. Coudin, Coriart, Savigny, and a number of infantry officers and a smattering of passengers comprised the leadership of the raft and provided the group with some hope, calling for morality, courage, and intellect to persevere in such desperate times. These encouraging words helped to soothe the restlessness, but not for long. Food and water was in extreme shortage, with just 2 barrels of wine, 2 containers of water, and a soggy mixture of salt water and flour. A plan was devised for portioning out their meager rations, but the flour was gone after just the first day, and the wine ration was a paltry 3/4 of a serving per day. Discussion of how to save themselves kept their minds busy and panic at bay for a time. But it was vengeance more than anything else that fueled their desire to survive. Seeking anything that could help them, they searched for the charts, maps, an anchor, or any other tools that Lieutenant Renault promised were on board, but they found nothing. The raft lacked even a compass, but Alexandre Coriart remembered seeing a man with a compass in his hand and quickly retrieved him. Excited, he handed the compass over, but it slipped and fell between the mishmash of planks and into the sea below. Coudin openly criticized Chaumaret, a sentiment shared by all others, save for one man, the governor's secretary, Griffon du Bellay, who maintained his loyalty to the captain and the governor. Henri Savigny, a surgeon, supervised the construction of a makeshift mast with the help of several sailors. The sail provided a small amount of propulsion, although there was still no method to steer. At sunrise on day 2, now July 6th, about a dozen people on the raft had their arms, legs, and heads trapped and twisted between the crisscross of timbers during the night. They suffered immensely, groaning in agony until they passed out of consciousness and died. Throughout the day, hunger and thirst were made worse by the overbearing sun. At dusk, tension and anger began to spread once again among the soldiers, who were furious with the sailors for putting them in this predicament. Their suffering was made even worse when a fierce storm erupted, battering the raft and washing waves over the terrified passengers. Those who could lashed themselves to the raft to prevent being thrown overboard. With the stern and bow of the raft unstable and mostly underwater, men shifted more toward the middle of the raft. This rush to reach the relative safety at the raft's center caused terrible overcrowding, and several men were crushed to death or drowned. When the storm finally subsided, many of the soldiers were in a state of utter despair and broke into the supply of wine by punching a hole in a cask. The men became extremely intoxicated as they quickly slugged down as much as they could in their tin cups. They only stopped when enough seawater entered through the hole in the cask, making the wine unpalatable. The soldiers' rage over their dire situation was further multiplied by the alcohol, and they turned their anger toward everyone on board. Hell-bent on killing everyone, they began smashing and dismantling the raft. A melee erupted between the soldiers on one side and the group of leaders on the other. When one soldier attempted to hack apart the ropes holding together the raft, he was impaled by the saber of an infantry officer and pushed overboard. The unruly soldiers then turned on the leaders who had gathered around the makeshift mast. The mutinous soldiers outnumbered their opponents and continued their onslaught in waves. They attacked with knives, sabers, and anything they could find. Many were thrown into the sea, including the only woman on board, along with her husband. Alexandre Coriart, hearing her screams, tied a rope around himself and jumped into the sea to save her. Once back on board, she found her husband had been saved as well, and the couple tearfully embraced. The battle raged on until all were too exhausted to continue. By nightfall, a calm finally came over the raft and the mutineers were silent for the time being. This confrontation resulted in many deaths, and bludgeoned bodies were strewn about the raft. After a time, many of the soldiers came to realize what they had done and begged for forgiveness, which was granted. Corriard and Savigny later wrote of these men. They were the scum of all countries, the refuse of the prisons, where they had been collected to make up the force charged with the defense and protection of the colony. But peace on the raft didn't last long. Around midnight, the deranged soldiers once again worked themselves up into a frenzy and launched a new attack. Their assault was vicious and without mercy. The group of leaders, still armed and ready after the last attack, mounted a counterattack. Soldiers with no weapons kicked, scratched, and even bit at their foes. The soldiers seized upon Sub-Lieutenant Lozac, who they believed was another man, Lieutenant Danglars. They despised Danglars, who they believed treated them terribly in the past. But Danglars was not on the raft, having abandoned his men and the raft, choosing instead to stay on the frigate. Efforts were made to communicate this mistake to the soldiers, explaining that Lozac was not Danglars. But their pleas fell on deaf ears. The soldiers also had much dislike for Lozac, so any mistaken identity mattered little. The soldiers attempted to throw Lozac into the sea, but a group of men, including Corriard and Savigny, rushed them and prevented Lozac from being tossed overboard. This only enraged the soldiers even further. They demanded for Lozac to be handed over, so they could dole out their vigilante justice on the man. Another attack was launched by the soldiers, who were once again repulsed. Out of their minds with rage, the soldiers turned their attention to Cordain, who was holding a 12-year-old sailor boy in his arms. Cordain and the boy were thrown overboard by the soldiers, but Cordain held fast to the boy, and both managed to get back on the raft. Set on self-destruction, the rabble of soldiers threw two barrels of wine and the remaining two casks of water into the sea, before continuing their attacks. Despite their greater numbers, the soldiers were again beaten back and subdued, and at great cost. Finally, the violence subsided, but an uncomfortable nervousness persisted. At daybreak, the full carnage of the overnight battle became visible. Between 60 and 65 were dead or missing, almost entirely of the mutinous soldiers. Some, it was determined, threw themselves into the sea purposely. Of the 147 who set out on the raft, only 67 remained. Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections: Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections: Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016, and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections: Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. For the next 2 days, none aboard the raft had a morsel of food or a drop of water. Only a very small portion of wine was distributed to each person per day, barely enough to wet their swollen tongues. Despite the fatigue, efforts were made to bend metal scraps of the soldiers' tags into fish hooks, and a bayonet was even fashioned into a large hook to try to catch a shark. Their efforts proved to only drain what little energy they had left, and dampen any hopes they had of survival. It was July 7th, day 3 on the raft. Hunger and intense thirst forced the poor souls to eat bits of leather from their shoes, hats, and belts, as well as linen from their clothing. Wholly unpalatable and lacking any real nutrition, this source of food was abandoned. Out of pure desperation, the first acts of cannibalism took place on the Medusa, when some of the men approached the dead bodies about the raft, cutting off small bits and devouring them. As the soldiers consumed the raw human flesh, they noticeably regained their strength, prompting others to partake. Some could not stomach the idea, refusing to give in to such a barbaric practice. Thin slices of the flesh were hung on bits of rope in order to dry it, making it slightly more palatable. During the Age of Sail, cannibalism among shipwrecked sailors was not unheard of, although speaking of such acts was uncouth and no man wished to admit to such a thing. On the morning of the fourth day, about a dozen men were discovered dead and hanging on the side railings. These men, who were alive just hours ago, were pushed over the side, save for one, who was reserved to feed the remaining soldiers. But fortunes would improve later that day, when a large school of flying fish encountered the raft. Many of the fish flew into the raft and were seized quickly by the starving men. Many immediately bit into the raw and still wriggling fish. Approximately 200 fish were caught and placed into barrels for safekeeping. When a small amount of gunpowder was discovered, it was dried and then used to make a small fire in an empty casket. The fish were cooked over the fire, providing much-needed nutrition to all. However, the portions were small, and human flesh was added to supplement their meals. At this time, the infantry officers on board ate human flesh for the first time, having resisted while others regained their strength. This would be the last of the fire for cooking, as the gunpowder was entirely consumed. With their hunger satiated somewhat, all was calm as night fell on the fourth day. Fading into another miserable night of rest, there was some hope they would be spotted soon. The following day, however, would bring them nothing but more agony. During the night, a new plot was formed by the mercenaries from Spain, Italy, and Africa. They urged others to join them to destroy the raft and swim for the coast. When this plot was discovered by some of the sailors, these new mutineers were confronted. The leader among them, a Spaniard, threw himself into the sea rather than be killed by the sailors. Another among them, an Italian man, did the same. This confrontation ignited the fury of the mutineers once again, and a third bloody battle between them and the officers and sailors erupted. In the chaos, cries for Lieutenant Danglars rang out again, as the mutineer still wanted his head, despite the man not being on board. The mutineers refused to listen, and the battle continued. Once again, the outnumbered sailors and officers repulsed the attack, but lost five or six among their ranks in doing so. In total, 30 more died in the battle, littering the raft with blood and gore. Included among the dead was the young 12-year-old boy. Just 27 were left alive on the raft as day broke on the fifth day, but of these, 12 were seriously wounded. The men debated over what to do with the injured. Some proposed giving them half rations, but this was determined to only prolong their suffering. With much regret, the decision was made to push the injured overboard to allow more provisions and more hope to the living. This grisly task was given to 3 sailors and 1 soldier, to dispose of the injured who were still alive and aware of what was happening. Among those who were pushed into the sea was the lone woman on board who had suffered a broken femur during the battle, and her husband who received a deep wound to the head from a saber. This was a ghastly exercise. Most turned away and refused to look while the macabre deed was carried out. Coriart and Savigny apologetically wrote, "The victims had not above 48 hours to live, and by keeping them on the raft, we should absolutely have been destitute of the means of existence 2 days before we were found." With the sacrifice of the injured to the sea, only 15 remained, and they agreed to throw their arms overboard, keeping only one saber. For 6 more days, the men endured terrible suffering and deprivation. All were on the brink of death, and many wished death would come to ease their pain. Just as all hope was lost, a white butterfly hovered above them. As if a magic spell had been cast, the beleaguered men were filled with joy, knowing land must be nearby. However, it was their 9th day on the raft, and despite having a little hope, starvation and dehydration tormented them with every breath. Suffering under the stress, delirium was rampant. Seeking some small degree of comfort, they devised a small tent out of bits and pieces of the mast and sail. It wasn't much, but it shielded them somewhat from the unforgiving sun. More butterflies were seen in the following days, proving they must be close to shore. Even so, they inched closer to death, surviving still on small amounts of dried human flesh and sips of the dwindling wine. Day after day, and night after tormenting night, they became certain of their demise. Convinced they could fashion a smaller raft and sail to the coast, the men used bits and scraps from La Machine. To their utter dismay, it capsized immediately when the first men stepped into it. They decided they were certain to die and accepted their fate. On the 17th of July, their 13th day on the raft, the tops of a sailing ship could be seen at great distance. The men erupted in joy and peered into the horizon to get a glimpse. Some believed it was getting closer, but the ship eventually disappeared from their view. Coriart and Savigny described their outlook at the time. "From the delirium of joy, we fell into profound despondency and grief. We envied the fate of those whom we had seen perish at our side, and we said to ourselves, 'When we shall be destitute of everything, and our strength begins to forsake us, we will wrap ourselves up as well as we can. We will lay ourselves down on this platform, the scene of so many sufferings, and there we will await death with resignation.'" 2 hours later, the ship's gunner emerged from the tent and cried out, "Saved! See the brig close upon us!" Bewildered and weak, the men looked out. The brig was the Argus, and it was speeding toward the raft in all haste. The men embraced each other and praised God for the miracle of their salvation. The Argus pulled close to the raft and immediately sent a boat to retrieve the pathetic and wretched souls. Very quickly, all the survivors were aboard the Argus and were given as much comfort and aid as possible. They were given hot broth and wine, and their horrible open sores and wounds were bandaged. Mr. Reynaud, the surgeon on board the Argus, directed nutrition to be given slowly, understanding what rich foods can do to a starving man. The Argus, part of the original convoy, had made it safely to Saint-Louis and was commanded by Captain Parnahon. When the Medusa did not arrive on schedule, the Argus was dispatched to search for the frigate and its boats. It was a stroke of luck for the Argus to even find the raft, not being aware of its existence. The Argus searched for the Medusa, but failing to find it, began heading back to Saint-Louis. After the Argus was spotted and then disappeared from view of the raft, the wind shifted, prompting Parnahon to go with the wind and continue searching. Only then did he discover the raft of the Medusa, 90 nautical miles from the wreck of the Medusa and 32 nautical miles from the coast of Africa. When the Argus arrived in Saint-Louis, they were welcomed by Governor Schmaltz and other dignitaries, including French and British officers. All who witnessed these emaciated wretches could not help but weep over their suffering. French merchants provided them with assistance and care, as did British civilians of the settlement. While their miserable ordeal was over, six of the survivors, including Alexandre Coriart, were taken to the English hospital in Saint-Louis. Coriart would survive, but five others died, reducing the survivors from the raft to just 10. Captain Parnahon submitted his report to Governor Schmaltz, stating the following: "I found on this raft 15 people. These unfortunates had been obliged to fight and kill a large number of their comrades who had revolted in order to seize the provisions. Others had been taken by the sea or died of hunger or madness. Those that I rescued had fed themselves on human flesh for several days, and at the moment when I found them, the ropes which held the mast were covered with morsels of this flesh, which they had hung up to dry. The raft was also covered with scraps which further attested to the food which these men were obliged to consume."
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
After abandoning the raft, the small convoy of the Medusa's boats traveled together for a short time, before the longboat and skiff became separated from the others. Provisions were not a problem on the governor's barge, which carried a large quantity of food, water, and wine, while the captain's barge had less, but still adequate provisions. The survivors on the other boats suffered great deprivation, eating only one tiny bite of soggy biscuit and a small sip of wine or water per day. Long days under the relentless sun and miserable nights in rough seas took its toll on the haggard group. Anxious and grumbling sailors on the longboat insisted on being taken ashore, and the boat's commander, Lieutenant Espio, agreed. 63 of the sturdiest sailors were taken ashore and given arms and what meager provisions could be afforded. These men were landed at the southern tip of the Arguin Bank and began the long 300-mile journey to San Luis on foot. Those remaining on the longboat returned to sea and continued south toward Senegal when they again encountered the other boats of the convoy. The small skiff was falling apart and in danger of sinking, and its 15 occupants boarded the longboat. The tiny fleet continued toward Senegal, but again the longboat and now the Senegal boat lagged behind and lost sight of the others. Grumbling and miserable sailors on the Senegal boat insisted on going ashore, having already suffered several days at sea. And Ensign Maudet finally consented. Maudet took the boat ashore and smashed through the breakers, dumping the weak, bedraggled men on the beach. Seeing this, Lieutenant Espio guided his longboat to shore as well, and the two groups joined together. They landed near the abandoned settlement of Portendic, 120 miles north of San Luis, and started walking toward Senegal. The scout boat commanded by Ensign Laparere stayed with the governor's barge and captain's barge for a time, despite the demands of its occupants to land to the east. But the governor wouldn't allow it, commanding the boat to continue by sea. Laparere begged for more provisions, which were desperately needed, but the governor refused, deceitfully replying he did not have enough for his own vessel. Likewise, Chaumaret dismissed Laparere while sipping wine from an enormous jug. The governor's and captain's barges were discovered by the Echo, with Captain Villeneuve commanding, on July 9th. All were brought aboard the Echo and promptly taken to San Luis. Their time at sea was not pleasant, but they did not suffer the deprivation and agony of those on the other boats. While the remaining castaways from the Medusa were still fighting for survival, Captain Chaumaret, Governor Schmaltz, and their associated circle were back in San Luis enjoying great comforts. The scout boat battled fierce currents after becoming separated, when Laparere spotted a figure on a hill just beyond the beach, waving frantically to them. Recognizing the person as a survivor from the Medusa, he hoisted a white flag on the end of a musket in response. Laparere guided his vessel swiftly toward shore. Its passengers, along with what little provisions remained, were dumped into the violent surf when the boat capsized. Among them were the Picard family, who had been transferred from the skiff to the scout boat shortly after leaving the Medusa. Charlotte Picard writes of this experience. "The last sea rushed upon us with the impetuosity of a torrent. We were up to the neck in water. The bitter sea froth choked us. The sailors threw themselves into the sea. They took the children in their arms, returned, and took us upon their shoulders. And I found myself seated upon the sand on the shore, by the side of my stepmother, my brothers, and sisters, almost dead. Everyone was upon the beach except my father and some sailors. But that good man arrived at last to mingle his tears with those of his family and friends." The castaways from the longboat, skiff, scout boat, and now Senegal boat were all reunited, and after a short rest, set off for Senegal. Capture and enslavement by the Moors was a legitimate concern, and the group did their best to stay together. However, two men of the Philanthropic Society named Cummer and Rogery broke off into the desert in search of a Moorish tribe who might provide them with comfort. We'll return to their story just a bit later. The expanse of barren, scalding desert before the castaways was daunting and relentless, but they had no choice but to continue if they wanted to survive. The hot sand burned the feet of those without shoes, and filled the shoes of those who had them. Charles Picard's family included some very young children, and they struggled to keep up, aggravating some of the officers who accused the family of endangering them. Furious, Picard unleashed a verbal assault, defending his family and questioning the honor of these men as Frenchmen. Other officers assisted the family and would stay behind with them when needed to provide assistance. The ragged band of survivors marched through the scalding, hot desert, suffering greatly, subsisting primarily on a putrid white liquid which could be found under several feet of sand. Small bits of purslane were collected from beyond the dunes to provide them with a small amount of nutrition. On several occasions, they encountered small bands of Moors, who at times appeared threatening, and other times, friendly. When entering their villages, the French castaways were often taunted by the Moor women, who spit at them. Ultimately, the Moor women sold them goat's milk, butter, and a mixture of camel's milk and urine. More importantly, some of the Moorish men offered to guide the survivors to Saint-Louis. On the 11th of July, 6 days after departing the Medusa, they spotted a French ship offshore. Their Moor guides courageously swam out through the breakers with a message from Espio, and returned with a message from Captain Parnahon of the Argus, who was searching for the Medusa. The guides also came back with barrels of cheese, wine, biscuits, and water, giving the desperate entourage much-needed nutrition and also hope. As the castaways got closer to Saint-Louis, they were found by an Irishman named Kearney, who had been sent by the English Colonel Brereton from Saint-Louis to search for survivors of the French wreck, which he had learned of. Kearney guided them the remaining distance, as the environment became more and more lush and green as they approached the Senegal River, a stark contrast to the endless dunes of sand they had encountered for many days. On July 13th, the ragged and half-dead survivors finally reached Saint-Louis. They had spent 4 days adrift at sea and 5 days trudging through the unforgiving desert, all the time in great despair. Upon reaching Senegal, they were greeted by English and French officials. Colonel Brereton and other English officers and civilians showed great care and sadness for the survivors, much more so than their French counterparts. Charlotte Picard recalls, "My father presented us to the English governor, who had alighted. He appeared to be sensibly affected with our misfortunes, the females and children chiefly exciting his commiseration. And the native inhabitants and Europeans tenderly shook the hands of the unfortunate people. The Negro slaves even seemed to deplore our disastrous fate. Most of the population of Saint-Louis arrived to greet them and provide assistance, but Governor Schmaltz and Captain Chaumeret were notably absent." Word of Charles Picard's fury and insults over the treatment of his family were no doubt reported to the governor, and he was not one to forgive such intransigence. The castaways were taken in by French merchants and English families. Those in the worst health were taken to the English hospital, where proper care and hygiene were lacking. Most of the Picard children were housed with an old friend of Charles Picard, while Charlotte Picard and her sister Caroline were comfortably lodged with a kind English family named Kingsley. The two sisters struggled with their return to civilized life, as Charlotte recalls, "In the midst of my misfortunes, my soul has preserved all its strength. But this sudden change of situation affected me so much that I thought my intellectual faculties were forsaking me. When I had a little recovered from my faintness, our generous hostess conducted us to the saloon, where we found her husband and several English officers sitting at a table. These gentlemen invited us to partake of their repast, but we took nothing but tea and some pastry." Having lost all of his family's possessions on the Medusa, Charles Picard was penniless and unable to lodge his family. He pleaded with Governor Schmaltz for assistance, but the resentful governor dismissed his requests. Picard was forced to beg and borrow to rent a small apartment to house his family. Native people from the area provided him with donations of food and supplies, having taken notice of the family's plight. An English officer who was greatly moved by the Picard family's struggle to survive arranged for the mayor of Saint-Louis to provide the family with the same rations afforded to English officers. Great kindness was shown by this officer, whose country was at war with France just a year prior. The 15 survivors from the raft arrived on the Argus on July 19th, And the following day, the group of men who disembarked on the longboat arrived after a 300-mile trek through the desert. They faced similar deprivations as the others, negotiating relations with the Moors and acquiring provisions and guidance from them. Several of their party perished along the way, as the grueling march proved too much. On July 23rd, the two men who set off on their own, Rogerie and Cummer, arrived in Saint Louis with Moorish guides. They wandered through the desert, eventually being found by a tribe of Moors and taken to their king, named Zaid. Cummer spoke a bit of Arabic, much to the delight of the Moors, and was treated well. Rogerie, however, was spat on, pinched, and taunted. The king provided them with protection, as he wished to speak with them about France and news from other lands. The men stayed with the king for a time before being moved to another village, and then guided through the desert and down the coast to Saint Louis. The last of the passengers of the Medusa to be accounted for were those 17 who refused to board the raft or any of the boats and remained on the frigate. Governor Schmaltz and Captain Chaumeray had done little to attempt to rescue these men. On July 26th, a ship was sent out to the Medusa. The ship was an unseaworthy schooner owned by the financier of the Philanthropic Society, a man named Darassou. Governor Schmaltz had shady arrangements with Darassou in order to profit from the discovery of any of the ship's valuables. The schooner set out on the 26th, but could not make any progress due to foul weather. A second attempt was made, and again, it was forced to turn back when its sails were damaged in a gale. Finally, on the third attempt, the ship successfully left port and found the Medusa, a staggering 52 days after it was abandoned. Its hull was shattered, and the ship rested on her port side. Inside, three ghastly skeletal human beings were found, wild and aggressive. The only provisions left on the frigate were bottles of brandy, and the men threatened each other with knives, protecting what little they had in their stash. A fourth man who survived those 52 days had died just hours before, and he was rolled into the sea. The 17 men stranded on the Medusa subsisted on biscuit, bacon, prunes, wine, and brandy for 42 days. But when these provisions were gone, 12 of the men cobbled together a raft and set out for shore. They were never seen again, although their raft was found by King Zaid. Another man attempted to float to shore on a chicken coop, but it quickly sank and he perished. The rescue schooner took the three men on board and salvaged what they could from the Medusa before returning to Saint Louis. All the items recovered from the Medusa were treated as prizes. Schmaltz, Chaumeray, and other officers, including Lieutenant Reynaud, made off with valuables from the ship in order to sell them for a profit at a week-long town market. Everything was sold, including the French flag from the ship, which had been made into napkins and tablecloths. All manner of personal items, clothing, vases, and furniture were sold, even when those items were property of survivors who had returned to Saint Louis. Alexandre Coriard, a scientist by trade, was infuriated with Schmaltz and the pillaging of the valuables. All of his expensive equipment had been plundered and sold and would not be returned to him. All future items seized from the wreck were sold, with Schmaltz receiving 50% of all profits. The disaster and tragedy of the Medusa was caused by the callous actions of its leaders and was now being played out in the same manner. The Echo left Saint Louis on July 29th, carrying a letter from Schmaltz to French Minister of the Navy, Viscount Dubachage, who happened to be an ultra-loyalist monarchist and émigré like Schmaltz and Chaumeray. Also on board were 55 survivors of the Medusa, including Lieutenant Espiot, Ensign Laperere, Midshipman Caudin, and Henri Savigny. The latter two men survived the horrors of the raft and could provide valuable information. When the ship arrived in Brest on September 2nd, a telegraph was promptly sent to Dubachage with news of the wreck. Captain Venancourt of the Echo, aware that Savigny had been writing a narrative, sent a copy of it to a friend, who was asked to deliver it to the French Naval Ministry. But instead, the damning narrative was sent to Ily de Caz, the Minister of Police, and a trusted confidant of Louis XVIII. Decazes was a moderate and did not wish for the ultra-loyalists to be elected to the new Chambre Introuvable, or Chamber of Deputies. The king had banished the chamber recently due to alarming, radical policies that threatened to throw the country into civil war once again. Decazes saw the mishandling of the Medusa by ultra-loyalist émigrés to be just what he needed to damage their reputation. The news spread quickly, first on September 6th, and then further leaked to the anti-Bourbon newspaper Journal des Débats on September 13th. The scandal raged through France as the French people learned of the shameful tragedy and of the resulting deprivations and acts of cannibalism. The public were outraged at such incompetence, with their anger directed specifically at Captain Chaumareix. Debouchage, having been outmaneuvered by Decazes, wrote to the king, "Journalists have revealed events that should never have been placed before the eyes of mankind." The scheme by Decazes worked as intended, as public support of the ultra-loyalists waned, and the new elections gave control of the new chamber to the moderates. A court of inquiry was launched in November of 1816 to investigate the wreck of the Medusa. The testimony of Henri Savigny, Lieutenant Espiot, and Ensigns Maudet and Laperere were especially damaging to Chaumareix, as they described the role of Antoine Richefort and all of the missteps, errors, and carelessness throughout the Medusa's journey. They also told of Chaumareix leaving the Medusa while others remained on board, and of Lieutenant Reynaud cutting the tow rope attached to the raft. Chaumareix's own correspondence was used against him, which left out key details of the incident and even the existence of survivors wandering in the desert. The mountain of evidence and firsthand testimony was overwhelming, and the court found Chaumareix guilty of negligence. In Senegal, Schmaltz and Reynaud attempted to coerce Alexandre Corriard to sign their testimony of events, which differed greatly from the truth. Corriard outright refused to sign it, believing the attempt to be a certain indication of their guilt. Captain Chaumareix arrived back in France in December of 1816. Upon his arrival, he wrote to the French naval ministry, requesting several months of rest before being reassigned. Instead, Chaumareix was arrested. His official court-martial began in January of 1817 and included testimony from 23 witnesses, followed by Chaumareix himself. Ironically, he began his testimony by misquoting his age by 3 years, which did nothing to bolster his credibility. Chaumareix was found to be guilty of a breach of discipline for leaving the ship's log on board the Medusa, which would have been valuable evidence for the court-martial. However, the log of Captain Venancourt of the Echo provided this information regarding the arrogant captain. Evidence of Chaumareix's incompetence were described, including failing to recognize Cape Blanc, the lack of communication provided from the Medusa, failing to take regular soundings, and abandoning his vessel while others remained on board. Despite the overwhelming evidence, the officials presiding over the court-martial found Chaumareix not guilty of negligence for separating from the convoy off the coast of Spain, not guilty for the loss of the Medusa, and not guilty for abandoning the raft. However, he was found guilty for causing the shipwreck and for abandoning his ship before all others had evacuated. This was a capital offense with a penalty of death. Chaumareix's lawyer, however, secured a stay of execution from Dubachage, which the king supported. Finally, on the 3rd of March, 1817, final judgment was handed down. Chaumareix was removed as an officer of the Navy and declared incapable of serving in the king's service ever again. But rather than a death sentence, he was given just 3 years in prison and ordered to pay court costs. This lenient sentence outraged the public and moderates alike, while loyalists considered this punishment far too harsh. Survivors of the Medusa were outraged as well, recalling the horrors of human suffering and degradation that resulted from the incompetent, callous, and arrogant Chaumareix. Such was the monumental philosophical and socio-political gap in France at the time. Viscount Hugues Duras Chaumareix served his 3 years in prison, but was permitted to choose an open-air prison close to his home and was relieved of the responsibility of paying court costs. He petitioned to have his medals and honors restored, as well as his pension, although these requests were denied. He lived out the rest of his days in disgrace and seclusion with his wife, haunted and troubled over the Medusa affair. Whenever he showed his face in public, he was harassed, insulted, and children even threw stones at him. His wife Sophie passed away in 1837, and his son died the following year. Chaumareix lived as a poverty-stricken recluse until his death in 1841. Governor Julien Désiré Schmaltz was relieved as governor of Senegal in 1820, but continued to work for the French government. He was assigned first to Mexico and then to the Greek city of Smyrna. Schmaltz died virtually penniless in 1827. Jean-Baptiste Henri Savigny, co-author of the damning narrative of the Medusa, put the tragedy of the Medusa behind him and stayed out of the controversy and political dealings. He married and served as mayor of Soubise and later received the Légion d'honneur from King Louis-Philippe, along with all other survivors of the now infamous raft. Savigny was troubled throughout his life, suffering from depression and grief. He died in 1843. Savigny's co-author, Alexandre Corriard, was terribly ill at the time of his rescue, and it took much time for him to recover. In 1831, he returned to France and actively lobbied in support of the victims of the Medusa, for whom justice had not been adequately served. Corriard went on to develop railway projects, but became embroiled in many disputes regarding the quality of his work and his pay. In 1848, he retired to his chateau with his wife Hortense, where he found himself in further disputes with his neighbors. Alexandre Corriard died in 1857 at age 79. Charlotte Picard married a schoolteacher in Saint-Louis named Jean Dard in 1820. Dard had generously helped care for the Picard children following the Picard family's arrival in Saint-Louis. The couple returned to France, and Mrs. Dard published her account of the Medusa tragedy in 1824, and an English version was published in 1827. They returned to Senegal, and Charlotte Dard died in 1862 at the age of 64. Charles Picard sadly died in 1820. As for the charlatan Antoine Richefort, it was discovered later that prior to boarding the Medusa, he had been imprisoned in England for the past 10 years. This ex-convict had next to no experience as a mariner or a navigator, and was directly responsible for the wreck of the Medusa. Richefort survived the shipwreck and eventually made it safely to Saint-Louis. He later attempted to write his own version of the events, which was wholly distrusted. In Savigny and Corriard's narrative, they write, "At the moment that we publish a second edition of our narrative, we learn of a pretended account by Monsieur Richefort, an auxiliary ex-officer of the French Marine. Our readers will not have forgotten a certain pretended sea officer who was partly the cause of our misfortunes, and who, when on board the Medusa, gave such unhappy advice to the captain, who still more unhappily followed it too closely. Well, this ex-officer, this fatal auxiliary, who conducted the frigate upon the bank of Arguin, is no other than Monsieur Richefort. Having gone on board the governor's boat, he remained a stranger to the disasters which he had partly caused, and consequently knew nothing of what had passed, either upon the raft, or on board the boats which stranded, or in the desert. We make no farther remarks. The public will judge of his account and ours." What became of Antoine Richefort and his life following the events of the Medusa is unknown. The wreck of the Medusa inspired the young French painter Théodore Géricault to create his now famous piece, The Raft of the Medusa. Géricault even personally interviewed Henri Savigny and Alexandre Corriard to hear the accounts firsthand. After news of the Medusa became known, Géricault created a scale model of the raft and inspected dead bodies from the morgue to recreate realistic colors and textures. Throughout 1818 and 1819, Géricault painstakingly created his masterpiece. Géricault depicts an overcrowded raft with desperate human forms, both living and dead, piled on top of each other. Despite the graphic depiction of suffering, it also conveys hope as survivors reach out toward an approaching ship in the distance. The painting originally was controversial and was moved from France to England, where it was praised. Originally titled Scenes of a Shipwreck, it subsequently became known as The Raft of the Medusa. The enormous painting is 16 feet tall and 23.5 feet wide and can be viewed today at the Louvre in Paris. That brings the story of The Raft of the Medusa to a conclusion. Thank you so much for joining me for this special two-part episode. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can follow the show on social media at Shipwrecks Pod. Images, sources, show notes, and transcripts for this episode can be found at shipwrecksandseadogs.com. where you can also find Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs merchandise. You can buy yourself a nice shirt and also help support the show. It's a win-win. Want to hear Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs without ads? Subscribe to the Into History podcast channel for ad-free episodes, bonus content, and a private community. You'll get access to all the great podcasts of Into History, including History Daily, American Revolution Podcast, Wild West Extravaganza, and many more. Subscribe at intohistory.com/shipwreckspod. Original theme music is by the mysterious Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him on YouTube at Sean Secret or at seansiegfried.com. Please join me again for a new episode in 2 weeks. But until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.